Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, offering radiation cancer treatment from over 30 physicians at 20 locations in the Charlotte regional area. Details at treatcancer.com.
Hey, y'all, I'm Tommy Tomlinson, and from WFAE in Charlotte, this is Southbound. In the middle of the North Carolina Piedmont, halfway between Charlotte and Raleigh, there's a little town called Seagrove that's famous for one thing, pottery. Dozens of potters live and work there, continuing a tradition that has lasted in Seagrove for more than 100 years. Ben Owen III is a descendant of one of the first families of Seagrove pottery. He brings his family's values into every piece he makes.
It's better to work on the quality of something than the quantity of it. And no matter how proficient you become and how you can do it in repetition or working with a design of it, but each pot is really going to be the sketch for the next one.
Ben's work appears everywhere from the Smithsonian to hotels and galleries all over the world. He has spent his life turning lumps of Carolina clay into works of art. Here's our conversation. So, Ben Owen, I want to ask about your hands. How long have you been, you've been making pottery for how long now?
Well, I've been, as of this year, it's about 40 years since I first started putting my hands in the clay and working with it. So about four decades now.
And I wonder, just what does that do to your hands over that time? How does making all those pots, how has that affected your hands?
Well, that's a good question. I've had some people ask me, do I have complications with my wrist or my hands or my fingers, or do my fingers go to sleep at night? And if I do a lot of repetitive designs, like a similar shape over and over, your hands will tend to want to be positioned in a particular manner working with the clay. And I think that makes a difference in affecting your hands, and you'll feel it after that. So I've learned over time to try to mix it up, do a little bit of this style or that style, or take a break and go do paperwork. Or I think another thing, too, that really affects, especially my right hand, is using a mouse on a computer. It will actually affect my wrist and my forearm more than making pots on the wheel. Just from that little clicking of a mouse.
So not the creative side, but the business side a little bit more. I know my wife did pottery for a while, and she always talked about how dry her hands were at the end of it every time. Do you have that problem when you're kind of playing
around? That's true, especially in the fall and the winter. I'm putting on lotion multiple times in the day just because my hands get really chapped. And it's really on the back side of my hands more than on the side that comes in contact with the clay and the act of shaping it. But it's the remnants or the leftover clay that is from the making that lands on or attaches to the back of my hands. And then it sits there and it just absorbs all the moisture out of your hand. And then from there, you start having some cracked or chapped skin. And so I've had some people ask, well, what kind of lotion do you use, Ben? You got to be an expert on that. But I think anything with a good amount of aloe. I've tried Utter Cream and other things like that too. But I think it's just the repetition of putting it on, and also how many times you're washing your hands in a day. And as a potter, you do that a lot.
Yeah, that's so for people who maybe are not familiar with Seagrove in general, could you sort of describe kind of how that came to be as a center for so much pottery?
Well, Seagrove historically was first settled by some families in the area, including my family, the Owen family, that came a little bit later on. But the Coles and the Cravens, the Teagues, McNeils, Almonds, Crisco, just a lot of those families came to the area, and they found good farmland, and that was their primary need for supporting their families. But also, some of those families, they came with skills and talents they learned either from being up in the Northeast and when they first came into America, their families, and then they gravitated toward the South and moving into Central Carolina. And they found the good clays that they could make pottery, make a lot of the types of jars or vessels that were needed on an everyday basis, whether it be for food preparation or food storage or even candlelight. Making candle holders, or even chamber pots. So it's kind of,
a little bit
some
everything.
Of the things that people don't necessarily want to have to talk about, but right. You got to have a vessel to use for that. So
sure.
They didn't, for where Seagrove is, it's not close to any major city or town. That, of course, you know, Greensboro, Piedmont Triad area, Charlotte was developing, and then Raleigh-Durham Research Triangle Park. Those areas, there would probably be more things available just because of what was being brought in. But for remote areas like where we are in Seagrove, potters were really relied upon to supply the basic needs, as well as a basket maker or a seamstress or someone that weaves or in that fashion.
And back then, from the stuff you see, maybe some old stuff that your family did or whatever, did you see that they were trying to do some of that as art as well as just purely functional? Or I guess I'm asking, did you see some art in even the oldest things that they made?
Well, I believe there is some element. What we've seen, some of the evidence of it through some of the early pots that have been discovered just in the last several decades. Looking at those pieces and looking at the forms and designs, how they were inspired by Asian culture. You could see some even from other European background, whether it being Spanish or other types of style of pottery, French-style pottery that was. You could see the lines or a way of a handle was made or the curvature of a vessel was made to be mimicked like one of those that they had seen, or maybe one of them was brought over with them from Europe and then it came into a family and then they asked a local potter to make it and it became part of the potter's vocabulary of making that form because of the influence of that.
And one of the people who was making those cultural connections was your grandfather, is that right? Didn't he see some pieces in New York and other places that sort of gave him some ideas?
It is true. My grandfather came along at a time when there was a lot of transition and change in North Carolina, especially. Prohibition had taken place, and the need for whiskey jugs and elements of that and containers like that, it was kind of a market that wasn't there anymore. And you either had to go and work in other occupations, be a full-time farmer, or go work in a textiles mill, or work in some other kind of, like, be a carpenter or something like that. But during that time, there were other potters, like the Cole family and the Cravens. They looked at things, and even North State Pottery over in Sanford. A lot of those things, A.R. Cole as well over in Sanford, they were looking at forms from arts and crafts movement. And the Busbys, Jacques and Juliana Busby, came back in the early 1900s, and they found potters in the Seagrove area. They didn't directly come to Seagrove. They went to what they would judge a craft fair or a flower show or a display over in Lexington at the county fair or other places in the state. And they were involved in the arts, and they had an artistic background. Mr. Busby was a painter. And Juliana Busby was more of an enthusiast, encourager of different crafts and designs, and especially more gardening and with her theme. But she really loved growing flowers. And so the type of vessels that the flowers were placed in played a key role in how it looked even more beautiful. And so eventually they found potters down in the Seagrove area by finding some of those pots at one of those local fairs in Lexington and other places. And they began to ask questions, well, where is this pottery made? Why are they still doing it? And some of the farmers would tell them, well, it's really not much of a craft now because they've had to go work in other occupations. They just, Industrial Revolution and other things are now supplying glass and metal containers and or even on an industrial level of ceramics that local potters really couldn't compete with that when people could go buy it less expensively. And so with that being said, the Busbys really took it on as a mission to go and work with potters in the Seagrove area. They had numerous potters to work for them at their remote locations, like my great-grandfather Rufus Owen, his brother J.H. Owen, who became a main potter for them eventually. And then eventually my grandfather came in the 1923 and began making pots for them at the age of 18 years old.
Where did the clay for those original potters come from? Was there a riverbed over there or something, or where did they get the clay?
Some of the clay can be found near some of the riverbeds, but usually back off of the river, just set back a little bit where there's not as much organic material in it. You can find some of the clays that have been weathered or because of the water movement and erosion over a long period of time. we've been able to find a lot of those clays that are still there. We actually own one of the pieces of property now that a lot of the potters would go to. It was called historically the Almond Clay Pit. And from there, we were able to purchase it just a few years ago, just in recent times. But in the past, we would just get permission to go in and dig the clay off the property, bring it back to our place, and go through the act of processing the materials and then make it into a workable clay. Not necessarily one clay by itself, but say we would go down 10 miles down the road and there's another clay down there that had a distinctive property, and then use the clay off our land, and then another clay a half an hour away. So it's kind of like a cake recipe in a way. It's you can't just rely on one clay alone. You have to find a way to mix it together that's going to be more successful and a more reliable product.
And is there anything distinctive about the clay in the Seagrove area? Like, I know the Catawba potters in South Carolina, that clay that they use has a color that you don't see in a lot of other pottery. Is there something about the Seagrove clay that makes it special in any way, or is it just the people who use it?
Well, I believe at first it was just out of necessity. They found the clays in the area, but I think over time they were able to start picking and choosing the type of clays based on the application. And some of the colors were really dictated by those type of clays. More of a gray clay, kind of yellowish gray, would produce the beautiful salt glaze wares, where you're really just putting a transparent finish. In our sense of making salt glaze wares, we're taking the salt and throwing it into the kiln at a high temperature, and the salt vaporizes, and the salt begins to create a skin or a surface on the pot. And so the color of the finish of the pottery is really dictated by the color of the clay that you used. So if you used a really rich red clay, like a terracotta clay, or most commonly people think of pottery or red clay with bricks being made here in the state because we're a big brick manufacturer here in the South. But the red clays would create more of a kind of a chocolate brown color if you put it in the same firing process, or if it had enough of the iron concentration in it, it would actually start melting if you overheated it. So you would have a puddle of pots in the kiln and have a disaster. So I'm sure a lot of that happened along the way for those early potters. They had to kind of test materials and see what was going to work. And, well, we can't use that clay anymore. It's a disaster. So you learn along the way in picking and choosing the type of clays based on what you want to make with it.
I know that your great-grandfather and grandfather I did this for a living, or well known for it. Your dad, it sounds like, did some, but maybe not as much. And from the best I can tell, you sort of got the bug for this from your grandfather. Is that right?
Well, it is true. A lot of people felt like that kind of skipped a generation with going from my grandfather to my interest in clay. But I was about 4 years old when my grandfather retired making pottery, and he had to retire due to complications with his health. So from there, he would take me out after school and weekends when I was about 8, 9 years old at the time. And we'd just go out there and he'd show me how to process the clay and slick it down and then bring it back to workable consistency. Because literally when he closed the door, he just closed the door. The clay dried out. Everything was still sitting there. And he just didn't really feel like going back out there. And he enjoyed his career, but he was ready to retire. But when he saw an opportunity to teach me a little bit about it and just see if I was interested in it, I took the time to really go in there. And I always looked up to my grandfather. He was just such an amazing man. And he loved spending time with me after I got out of school next door. The school was just literally walking distance next door. And so I would spend afternoons out there and just sitting on the porch. And we'd sit there for a little bit and he'd say, well, there go those chicken trucks down the road. And I would look and it would be one of the yellow school buses. And I was like, well, why is he calling those chicken trucks? And it's like, well, yeah, you hear all those chickens cackling on there when they were down. So my grandfather was
that sounds
quite
like grandfather humor.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, so he was always had a sense of humor to him and always liked to have fun. So, but with that being said, he would take me out and show me a little bit about the clay. And I always wondered why we had all these pots on our bookcases. I mean, there were books in the bookcases too, but there were a lot of pots everywhere in my grandparents' home and even in my parents' home. And so I just thought, well, that's really interesting, you know, all this pottery. When I would ask him, well, what, you spent your whole career making pottery? And so, you know, I really was eager to get my hands in the clay and try it out just for the fun of it. But in 1979, Joan Mondale came to visit my grandparents. And
so Walter Mondale's
wife, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
And so while he was vice president, and Joan Mondale was a potter. She actually did some pottery on the side from what we understood. And so she wanted to come and visit with my grandfather and have a chance to meet him and see his work and showed some of the pots in the house and stuff. But to back up a little bit, my parents pulled me out of school one day because of this, and they just said, we have a very special guest coming to visit your grandparents, and we want you to be there for it. And so I walk out to the house next door, and then all of a sudden, there's all the Secret Service agents and all the security out there and everything. I'm like, oh, gosh, what's happened? And so and then I find out that it is Joan Mondale, and my parents tell me a little more about it, and because they were trying to keep it quiet, I guess, up till that point. And
right.
And so I was more interested in the Secret Service agents with their ear things. They could talk to somebody inside, and they were letting me talk to my parents. And all. So I just kind of thought that was kind of cool and everything. But then I go in the house, and I meet her, and then we have persimmon pudding, and we have afternoon tea, and just it was really interesting. I mean, even as a 10-year-old at the time going in there, and I thought, well, gosh, this pottery must be really important. So I just, from that point on, I just always thought, all right, I really want to try to do this more, and I really want to learn more about it. And so it just became every afternoon or whenever I had time between schoolwork or other activities, and I played sports some too and things along the way. But over time, my grandfather taught me up until I was about 15 years old on the wheel making pots, and my dad equally, he was more of a kind of a business person, and he had taken a break just a little bit from clay and went to teaching for a period of time. But when he saw I had an interest in working in clay, he decided, well, we need to get the shop back going again full time, and let's see if we can make a go at it. And we hired some local potters to come and work for us. David Garner was one of our first potters. He had learned how to make pots in a local community college in Montgomery County. And so he came and made pots just for basic things we need for the retail store made. And then I had some of my work in there. And so all of a sudden I started selling my pots, and my dad would tell people about what I was doing. And all of a sudden I had some pocket money. And so I was just kind of excited. I'm like, wow, I can make some money at this. So I didn't really put those two things together so much. But I was a pretty shy kid when I was young. I wasn't very outgoing so much at the time, and I just enjoyed doing what I like to do and with my friends and, you know, whatever a kid typically wants to have time doing. And so, but my grandma was always going to do a talk for either a garden club or a DAR group or other organizations, Kiwanis or different things, Rotary. And so whenever she was invited to go give a talk, especially about pottery or whatever gardening or whatever activity she was involved with, she told me I had to have my box of pottery ready with me and to make sure I had all the pots priced in the box. And I'm tagging along, and I'm going to have to give a talk to the audience before she gave her talk. So I would get out there, and I was really nervous.
I was going to say, how old are you?
I was about 13 years old at the time then. And so I'd been selling a few pots in the shop and talked to people, but for the most part, if somebody sent, like my grandfather or my dad would send somebody back to the studio where I was making pots in the back, I tend to make an excuse to go do something somewhere else. I didn't want to demonstrate in front of somebody because I was kind of nervous about it. But my grandfather and my dad really sat me down and just said, well, hey, you're only human. If you make a mistake on the wheel, and just grab another lump of clay and start on the wheel again and just say, hey, it just wasn't meant to be. So the same thing with my grandma taking me to a garden club or just to give a little talk in front of people. It really helped me to have a chance to be able to talk a little bit about what I like in doing in clay and how I enjoyed learning from my grandfather. And then just, it's just a great way to learn and explore new ideas. And so it really gave me a little more confidence along the way to kind of feel like it was something that I could continue on doing that my family had been doing in the past.
And what are some of the things your grandfather taught you about how to work the clay? I mean, what's sort of the things you still might use today or still keep in your mind?
Well, that's a good question. It's one of the biggest things I think my grandfather taught me early on was having some element of patience. And I think that patience comes in so many different forms in the world of pottery. either one in the idea of centering the clay on the wheel and having a true centered ball of clay. Imagine riding down the road and your tires are completely out of balance and they're just not really good, or your tires are worn out and your car is shaking. Well, it's the same kind of thing. When you don't have that ball of clay centered on the wheel and you try to just breeze on through that and, well, I'm done centering, I want to go ahead and open the ball of clay and start making the shape or the design of it. But if you skip those steps or go through it too quickly, it's going to magnify irregularities in the clay are really going to magnify as you begin to open it and pull the clay up. So I think one of the things that you really helped me to understand more was that it's better to work on the quality of something than the quantity of it. And no matter how proficient you become and how you can do it in repetition or working with a design of it, but each pot is really going to be the sketch for the next one. I think just having that good foundation was what really he set apart for me, and just making sure that I went through the steps to make sure that foundation was good before I went on to making a vessel. And I think that's really true, no matter whether we're a potter or whatever our careers are in. If we don't have a good foundation to build on, then it can really play a factor in what happens down the road.
When we come back, Ben Owen III talks about the similarities between two of North Carolina's favorite things, pottery and barbecue. That and more ahead on Southbound.
Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, offering radiation cancer treatment from over 30 physicians at 20 locations in the Charlotte regional area. Details at treatcancer.com.
This week on FAQ City. Some say sugar, others say sugar. Which one's right?
Sugar Creek.
Sugar.
Sugar.
Sugar Creek.
Sugar. I don't know, cigar?
And we find the answer to the 247-year-old question. Check us out on NPR One, Apple Podcasts, or online at WFAE.org. Support for FAQ City comes from Bojangles Chicken and Biscuits.
Each week on Southbound, we take a moment to highlight our listeners. This week, I want to thank friend of the podcast, Perry Beard, from Alpharetta, Georgia. He listened to our last podcast with Jimmy Russell, the master distiller nicknamed the Buddha of Bourbon. Perry emailed this comment: "Excellent. We should all have a job like Jimmy's. Ain't that the truth?" Tweet at me, at Tommy Tomlinson, or leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. Thanks to everyone for your kind words. Now, back to our conversation with Ben Owen III. I know all artists can see probably flaws in their work that other people can't. You brought some work with you today, a mug and three or four different vases of different types. They're spectacular. They're beautiful work to my untrained eye. But can you look at these and immediately see things that you wish you had done differently, or things that you didn't notice when you were making them but are sort of flaws in the work, or any of that sort of thing?
Oh, I'm constantly dealing with that every day. I guess in some ways I'm not saying I'm a perfectionist, but at the same time I'm always looking at ways of how can I fix this or that from the previous time. And even though I've worked with some of these glazes, like the earth tones or more of the ash glazes, or the purple colors that we've been developing recently with texture to them, or even the bright red glazes that we do, I think that how often you do it is really the key in any of these finishes, because I have to work with those. It's almost like doing different types of cuisines. If you work with Italian food, or you work with Japanese food, or you work with Mexican food or something completely different, you may use some of the tools or the pots and pans in the kitchen in a similar way, but the outcome might be quite different once you find the taste of it and the appearance of it as well. But with the glazes, because of we're at the mercy of a lot of the materials that come to us, whether we buy it from a supplier or we are using it and purifying the ingredients or processing them in advance before we actually use it on the pottery vessels, that the quality control that we have can vary so much because we're working in such small portions. And I think that that plays a role in how successful or how different the pieces look. And over the years, I mean, like if you're making a dinnerware set, you want it to look fairly consistent if you're going for that. I kind of like the idea of doing eclectic sets where I can have like a mixture of different things coming out and it's kind of a conversation piece around the table. But if you are trying to work with something like a set of something or a design of something, that you have to keep in mind in the back of your mind that you're really going to have to really expect something to come out a little different based on placement in the kiln, the materials that I mentioned earlier, as well as even down to the water we use. The water can change on us, the mineral content. And in the case of firing in a wood kiln, we also rely on local sawmills or lumber companies. They bring the excess or waste wood, the slabs that they have off the logs before they start cutting the lumber or cross ties and so on, that we use that waste wood. And so depending on where those trees grow in the ground, the minerals that are deposited into the tree are based on where that tree was growing. So there might have been a higher iron content in those trees that absorbed into the bark and so on through the water and absorption. So each firing can be a little bit different, or you could have an exact identical firing if you kept that wood separated. And so you can see by just the mercy of, or the fate of the materials that we work with, that even though we try to measure everything accurately every time in our recipes or how we make the pots, that the variation is going to come from just the raw ingredients being the victim or the results.
That's one of the things that has always fascinated me about pottery in particular, is that you can meticulously make a pot and you put the glaze on it, you have everything right, and then you put it in this blazing fire, right, in the kiln. How hot did the kilns get generally? I know it depends on what you're doing.
Yeah, some of the firings we do go anywhere from 2,300 to 2,400 degrees Fahrenheit at the hottest.
Right.
And also, I think the best comparison I've found is a couple of different ways that I can help people to understand more about the firing process is, one, the length of the firing. If you decide you're going to make brisket that day and you're going to have to go through a long process of making it and, you know, go over a long period of time, compared to putting a pizza in there.
Right.
If you put them both in there and go through that process, one's going to be successful and the other one's going to be a failure. So that can be said for many of our glazes. Some glazes have to be in a shorter duration of a firing. Otherwise, the pigments begin to start burning out or disappearing on the surface. Others, the only way you can have that surface to develop is because of the byproducts of the ashes from the wood firing. So in a lot of ways, we take the wood kiln to use it as a paintbrush or a method of adding color to the pieces, not only from the flame and the smoke that can affect the iron or other materials that are found in the clays, but also the ashes that come off the flakes of the coals. During the firing process in the firebox, it's like a cross draft effect in our kiln. So it's kind of a windblown look. So the ashes deposit and they flow through the draft going through the pottery, eventually going toward the chimney. And from there, as the ashes pass through, in the early stages, the pots are not really hot enough and melted enough, but the ashes will cling to the surface, especially if you have a combed surface or a tactile quality to the pieces. So some I purposely comb with like a saw blade, or I do some kind of surface treatment to the pots to grab the ashes and then eventually hold on to the pieces during the process. But eventually, when you reach 2,300 to 2,400 degrees Fahrenheit, the ashes that have deposited on the pieces will begin to melt, and they start running down. Just think about it in time-lapsed motion, like a molasses or honey pouring down the side of a pot. So it can really create an interesting effect on one side. So the front pot that's sitting on the front side will look different on the back side. It's almost like being at a concert. If you're on the front row of a concert, depending on what type of concert it is, if you're at a rock concert, you know what can happen being on the front row. You might have something thrown on you, or you might even be body surfing or whatever. But anyway, my point is people in the front are going to have a different reaction than those folks in the upper level.
The other thing that reminds me of so much, you know, as you're talking about the type of wood and how you want the smoke to get over, and all, it sounds very much like barbecue. you know, and I know you guys use a, is it a hogshead kiln? Or sometimes it's the, it, which reminds me of sort of built like a covered barbecue pit. It's this long sort of, describe what a hogshead kiln is. So
well, for people haven't the seen. Term is called a groundhog kiln.
Groundhog kiln.
Yeah,
I'm
groundhog
sorry.
Kiln. And so, but the reason it's named a groundhog kiln is very much the same, like you're talking about, like a barbecue pit. It's built down the ground, one for insulation, but also they would use the earth to actually hold and buttress the walls so that they could build an arch or kind of a Roman style or really more of a flatter arch over it. And that, that way they could stack the pottery inside and have the insulation on the ground helping as well. But the downside of that is sometimes you have to work on drainage and so water won't get inside the kiln. And but the water can actually benefit. We found with in the past, it's like, gosh, the pit got wet and now we got to drain all the water out or pump it out and everything. And it's going to be wet and messy loading the kiln. But in another way, the wetness actually helped promote other colors and affects the work because of the hydrogen and the water and the steam effect of it. But the water will actually change the color or promote different colors in the finishes.
It sounds like what you're talking about is this balance between consistency and unpredictability. Mm-hmm. That you, even if you may try to make four or five things look alike, it's basically impossible given the materials you're working with and the heat and all that sort of thing. So you have to kind of live with what the kiln brings you, right?
I think it's true. Some people have compared it to a kind of controlled chaos in a lot of ways. But I'm eagerly anticipating what has happened in the firing, especially if we've been through the whole cycle. We begin making pots and we work through a series of several weeks, depending on which type of kiln or that we have multiple kilns at our location. So once we go through the cycle of making everything, glazing, and then loading the kiln, we really want to know what the results are compared to a painter on a canvas. They may have to let the paint dry a little bit and see the changes after it's dried some. But with the pottery, you're really putting into the fate of the what's going to happen in the firing process. And hopefully things went well and you measured everything right. You took the temperature to the right point. And on a side note of that, I learned from my grandfather and my dad how to fire the kilns like older potters did by sight. So we would actually look in the kiln. We could tell how the glazes were smoothing over and melting just by visually looking into the kiln. And my grandfather had problems with cataracts and other complications with his eyes, I guess, from many years of looking into the kilns. And
right.
That greatly affected his vision and what happened later on in life for him. But
it's like staring at the sun, right?
Yeah, like staring at the sun in a lot of ways. But it really helped me to kind of know, even though we have more modern methods of pyrometers and we have pyrometric cones that stand and they melt over at specific temperatures, we can look in the kiln and know exactly what temperature it is based on those other two indicators. But if all else fails, the power goes out or the pyrometer, we can't read it anymore, we've got a way of looking in the kiln and to kind of tell what's going on visually.
Did you feel any family pressure to continue this tradition that's been going on for so many generations? I mean, did you feel like you needed to keep this going?
There was a point there at one time. A lot of people asked, well, you're going to be a potter, aren't you? And I thought, well, you know, I enjoy doing it and it's a lot of fun. And,
that's the point. That's the point where many kids would say, I'm going to do something else. You
yeah.
Know, right?
Yeah. And we talk about that with our kids today. We have a 17, 15, and a 12-year-old, our two older daughters, and then our son Benjamin. So they, Juliana and Benjamin, they'll make some pots from time to time. And if they want some spending money or they haven't worked enough or, you know, they've worked their chores and doing, getting some money that way, but I tell them, well, if you want some extra money, you know where the wheel and the clay is. And so they go in there sometimes, and they actually went with me for the first time last year to the Mint Museum show, and they both took a body of work with them, and they sold a lot of pots at the show, and they went home with some money in their pocket. So whether they become a potter or not, they have the opportunity and the surroundings, but I believe everybody's different as far as what they're, you know, what they want to do in life. And it's been great that we continue working in a tradition, and especially in the tradition of making pottery in the Seagrove area. But who knows? It might be a grandkid one day that, you know, that I'd spend time with them and they take an interest in it, that, you never know. It could be like what my grandfather and how it was with me. But I think it's important to, especially with kids today, in the light of how much technology is such a key role in people's lives, whether it's for fun and fun activities they can do, but also what they do in a career, that having a balance in life of having hands-on and doing things with your hands is really important element that we just don't want to see it being lost.
I saw when I was doing research for this, I saw a clip you did, a TV appearance, and as the host is talking to you, I think it was a kick wheel. You started the kick wheel and you put a lump of clay on there, and you weren't even really looking at the clay. You were looking at the person you were talking to, and this pot just sort of magically appeared in your hands as the wheel spun. It made me think, when you're working on these things now, are you concentrating hard and thinking hard about what you're making, or is it more instinctive? I guess what I'm asking is, are you using your mind more or just the feel for it more?
Well, I think like anything in a career, like a basketball player, they just know the exact motion they need to do to shoot a free throw or a three-pointer. Maybe not the best analogy, but it's the first thing I can think of that, you know, over time you find the ways of centering the clay and opening the ball of clay and then start the foundation of it, that from there you start really paying attention to pulling the cylinder up, and depending on if it's a vase or a bowl. But I think that some of the things are like memory. You just know the motion and the flow of it, but whether, no matter how confident you may be on the wheel, that you really need to take the time to make sure that you're pushing and pulling it in the right way. And I think that whole element of patience really plays a key role in it. And you build a sense of confidence, like you mentioned earlier, the feeling like it's effortless to shape it. But even so, there are little elements and little details. As I've told some folks, sometimes it's important to major on the minors. And when you look at what you're doing in clay, and I'll have potters to come up and ask me, well, what can I do to really change my work? And they bring me some of their pots, and some of the key things, the first things I see are, you know, just paying a little more attention to details, how you work on the rim or adding elements to the surface of the piece or how you treat the foot of the pot. Those kind of key things really help start accentuating the piece. If you go see my work compared to other people in the area, you're going to see very distinctive things. Doesn't mean one's greater than the other. It's just they're unique in their own ways. And I think that's what's really been a very wonderful drawing card for people coming to the Seagrove area, or if they're visiting Catawba Valley or up in the Asheville area, or just a few potters in a small town in Wilmington, North Carolina, that you're going to see things that they've been inspired by from other cultures or from other potters they may have worked with in a workshop. And I think that's what's really exciting for me, is that the tradition is being continued in so many other dynamic ways.
How do you feel like your style has evolved over the years? Like how, when you look at something you're making more recently compared to the stuff you made when you were first starting out, how has it changed?
Well, looking back on it, I think one of the key things that really affected my work was looking at my grandfather's work, and he was naturally, through the exposure to the Busbys and taking him to museums up in New York, to the Metropolitan, the Smithsonian, and other museums in the South, that they began to sketch out forms, or they looked at forms and designs, and they began to recreate some of those in their own way. It may not have been a carbon copy of that design, but they added elements to the shape or the form that was influence from a jar or a storage jar or jug that was made in the past, but they started adding their own little elements that they saw from Asian and Middle Eastern pots and so on. And so it really kind of created a hybrid of new shapes and designs that were going on. So to go fast forward to when I was growing up and looking at those pots that they did back then, the 1920s through the 60s and 70s, my opportunity was going to Japan and actually having a fellowship there. And so when I had the chance to go, and this was in 1995, I spent a summer working with potters in a village in Tokoname, Japan, south of Nagoya. And through that, I lived with a host family that never had a person from another country in their home before. It was all new for me, all new for them, and made lots of pots there. We worked with potters that were up to 10, 11, 12 generation potters in that village in Tokoname, and they were just as fascinated that I came from a traditional family of making pots, and how we compared things and compared notes about living in a family tradition. But it really helped me to kind of open up and understand more of the influences my grandfather had, looking at other outside influences. That was really what helped the craft continue in our community, was being adaptive and willing to try something new and something different than just sticking to the things that always been made in the past in the area. Those pots are still important, the functional nature of them, and people still continue making them today in the area. And I think that's wonderful. But now in the Seagrove area, to think about the body of Seagrove and other communities in our state, what a lot of people don't realize is how many people have moved as a destination to come to Seagrove, a potter from Estonia or from Japan or from Italy or Korea or all different places, England, all different places in the world. And we actually have people from all those different nationalities now living in Seagrove, and they have brought styles and designs of pottery that you wouldn't have seen probably 20 to 30 years ago. And I think that's what makes it really exciting for me, is to see that the tradition is staying alive and that we have something to offer, that especially being handmade. Nothing wrong with the department stores and what they offer, but we just feel like we have something unique to offer as well, and I think it will just continue the tradition.
What's something you see from that trip to Japan, or maybe from your grandfather's work, that you can sort of identify in yours?
I think probably one of the biggest things that I saw was how handles or contours of shapes were made. But the focus on the handles, or attention to detail and applying the handles, some of the forms back then may have been in a functional nature in Japan, maybe during the Edo period, or even in Chinese culture in Song Dynasty. Some of those forms were made either to tie or strap down a lid on the top of the piece, or it was more of a way to put a strap around it to carry water or other functional aspects. But from the shapes and designs that my grandfather and other potters were inspired by, those cultural icons, that the handles became more of a decorative element.
Yeah, I'm looking
more
at
of
that
accent.
The handles on a couple of the pieces you brought, and they're not things you could get your hand inside.
Yeah, a little bit smaller, yeah. A little bit smaller in design. You could still tie a strap around them,
sure.
Or do. But I think being complimentary to the shape, adding different types of handle attachments to the top or around a piece in multiple ways, really kind of give a different look to the piece, more of a design element that really helps to kind of give a life to the piece, or altering the pieces. Other things were, I saw in Asia, was more in China, where how they would do like melon forms, or like a form that's reminiscent of like a cantaloupe or kind of a pumpkin form. So when I was in college, I would look at forms in nature, and that was one of our assignments when I was in school, was how can you take some element or two from nature and integrate that into it? So some of the lines and things like that kind of helped me to remember when my parents would have a garden, and I would be out there helping in the garden and having all the things prepared and taking the weeds out. But then when it come time to gather or harvest the cantaloupes and things like that, I have great memories of going to the dinner table with that. But then how do we use that in a way of symbolically using these forms that we make in earthen vessels, and then how we can recreate that to something that could be an element of beauty that could have a nice arrangement of flowers in it, or give another type of life to the form.
Are there colors or glazes or shapes or forms that are still really challenging to you, or some little technique that you still have a hard time with?
That's a good question. Some of the forms I think that are probably the most complicated for me are the ones that are a little more like a gourd shape, kind of like almost like a pear, or kind of a gourd, kind of with a contour where it has a kind of a bellied base to it, and then it comes in, kind of tapers in, then it flares back out again to make another kind of bellied top to it. And the making of it can be very complicated, because you're taking the contour of the clay and going in and then back out. So there's always a chance of it collapsing when you start pushing on the surface because of that contour. But also the act of taking it off the wheel, too. You can collapse the piece by picking it up. So sometimes I have to use
that. So there's like several disaster spots there, right?
Yeah, so you have to pay close attention to those parts of the pot that could pose a problem, whether in the making or the literally taking off the wheel. So sometimes I use a heat gun or a torch just to kind of firm the clay up a little bit so it will stand more rigid, either in the finishing and the shaping of the piece, and then also in the act of removing it, that we don't have to start over again.
Yeah. And does that still, I mean, I know everybody who's ever tried pottery, whether it's like elementary school or taking a class, you've had the thing where you get it halfway done and it just falls over, collapses over. Does that still happen to you?
It can if, I think sometimes we have to kind of remind ourselves that we need to go through the steps and not do anything in haste. Try to make sure that you're going to go through the steps and make sure whether it's making a larger scale piece. The larger pots I make now, I do in sections, or I do a coil and throw method. So I'm literally adding a coil of clay on top of the rim of the pot. But if you do it while the clay is still a little too wet underneath, you could cause it to distort or alter or quite possibly collapse. I've had customers come in before, and I'd have three wheels going at one time, and all three of the pots were rotating on the wheel. And they would ask, well, you're not working on all three of those pots at one time, are you? And I'm like, well, yes and no. But one, I'm leaving them to rotate because I want them to dry evenly. But if the air conditioning's on, or if it's the heat's going in the wood stove, it could dry more on one side than the other. So again, major on the minors.
Yeah.
It's you have to really look at those little things, and that could be the success or the disaster of making a piece if you don't pay attention to those little elements.
Have you had types of pottery or projects that you just haven't had the time or the resources or whatever to do yet? Is there stuff out there you're still kind of pushing toward?
Well, as I've told some folks, that I have more than a lifetime worth of ideas and things I'd like to do, but I've got to try to fit them all in and what I feel are the most important ones in this one life. And so I think probably one of the biggest goals I have next would be, is because of the nature of making some of the larger scale pieces I do, I'd like to eventually build a kiln that I can go taller and design and style. Right now I can go up to about 5 feet tall for some of the pots, but with some of the techniques of coil and throw for some of the pieces I'm doing, some large pots, that if I had a taller kiln, I could go even larger and make it more of in a kind of sculptural nature. But I've made quite a few pieces in the last few years from here in Charlotte at the Ritz-Carlton Hotel. I spent about a year and a half making all the work for the installation when they were building the hotel, but I made about 70 pieces for that installation. And some of the pieces were quite large that went in the lobby. But others, I've worked on some projects out in Sun Valley, Idaho recently. I made some pots for a restaurant. They were about 4 foot tall, these covered jars that they requested. So I think that when I can have the ability to do some other pieces, more larger scale and on a different, you know, perspective to it, that I think it would really, really be a good challenge for me to work on those elements. But it sets up a whole nother group of things that you have to take into consideration making something even larger like that, especially if you have to make them outside, because think about it, trying to go through a doorway that's only 6'10" or whatever the door opening. So you got to start thinking about, all right, where am I going to do this?
I'm going to go through a garage. You're talking about building pieces that need clearance of some sort, yeah, right?
So we got to be able to get it out to the kiln. But I think too, just looking at forms that are receptive to the new colors that we're developing. We're creating a whole new line of work that has more of a kind of a textural effect to the surface, or microcrystals that form on the surface of the pots. We've been working in recent years with a matte glaze that comes out with the microcrystals. It has a kind of earth tone background, but these beautiful kind of not a periwinkle blue, but sometimes even like a deeper cobalt blue, but the crystals are that vivid blue over the earth tone background. But now we're creating greens and yellows and blues and even some with violet colors. And so it's going to be really interesting to see how those work in the future, just expanding more on our palette of colors.
And so you feel like you've got enough work ahead of you to keep you sort of your curiosity satisfied for a long time.
I believe so. I mean, what my body can provide for me to do, and I try to stay in shape. I mean, it's a physical workout just working with clay alone, but I try to exercise. I like to play tennis. People ask me, well, what else do you do other than make pottery? Well, I like to play tennis, and I like to do different things with, I'm a scout leader, Boy Scout leader for my son's scout troop. And so I help assistant scout master with that now. And so it's a lot of fun hiking and doing other activities with the boys and the group. And so I think those elements, it really helps me to kind of clear my mind when I can go and do some fun activities like that. So when I do come back to the studio, I really have a kind of a eagerness to get back in there and start making something new or working on whatever that may be at the time.
Ben Owen is meticulous about his work. The closer you look at one of his pieces, the more you marvel at the symmetry of the curves, the clean lines of the handles, the perfectly round openings in his vases. But during our conversation, what really struck me was something he said about mistakes. It was something his father and grandfather taught him. If you make a mistake on the wheel, just grab another lump of clay. I think a lot of us tend to forget that because we try so hard to make everything perfect, whether it's a piece of writing or a loaf of bread. Most of the time, there's nothing wrong with just starting over. There are moments when it's crucial to get everything just right, but those moments are probably fewer than we think. It's okay to give ourselves a break, to grab another lump of clay and try again. Mistakes are how we learn. In art and in life, they're often the only path to beauty. Southbound is a production of WFAE in Charlotte. Our producer is Nick Delacanal. Our web manager is Jennifer Lang. Our audience engagement producer is Joni Deutsch. And our main theme music comes from Josh Turner. If you have any thoughts about the show, ideas for future guests, or ways to get that perfect red glaze, email me at ttomlinson@wfae.org. You can listen to this and other episodes of Southbound on the NPR One app, Apple Podcasts, or your favorite podcast provider. You can also find us on wfae.org, where each episode has show notes and links with more information on that week's guest. Between episodes, look for the Southbound Radio Hour with a playlist of music based on the most recent episode. See y'all next time. Thanks for listening.
Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, offering radiation cancer treatment from over 30 physicians at 20 locations in the Charlotte regional area. Details at treatcancer.com.